This is a water session, and I'm J. Carl Ganter. I'm your moderator, host, whatever. As you probably have followed the water issues really closely, I will have each of our guests just very briefly introduce themselves. And the way we're going to do this, I run Circle of Blue. I'm a journalist and photographer. And Circle of Blue, we cover water issues around the world, the intersection of water, food, and energy. And what I'll do, I'll take people around the world and my little itinerary the last couple of years, just a quick toe in the water, and the different issues that I've seen and that our team has seen, give you a little bit of context. And then we'll have our speakers here and advisors and frontline observers tell you a little bit more about what they're up to. And maybe we'll just go down the row here quickly and have you each introduce yourself for 30 seconds, and I'll take you around the world, and then we'll come back and do about 7 or 10 minutes about various projects and observations and issues that you're all working on, which are important for all of us. And then we'll do the Q&A. And then the roles for Q&A are, as you said, to repeat the question. And we will repeat the question also, because this is being recorded for the website and posterity. Canons of knowledge, I heard. And then it'll be it. It'll be a really fast. We end promptly at 12:15, food will be awaiting us. So does that all sound good? Any questions? Cool. Okay. Great. Let's start at the end. Quick introduction.
Sure. Hi, I'm Julia McQuaid. I'm a researcher and an analyst with CNA, based in Washington, D.C. We're an organization that does research and analysis primarily in support of the federal government. A lot of the work we do is for the Department of Defense, Department of State. My background is in counterterrorism, primarily in the Middle East and Africa. I've been at CNA I've been in this line of work for about 15 years now, and increasingly moving into the space of trying to understand resource scarcity and its links to conflict and instability globally. So I'll be talking about a little research that we did over the past couple of years, specifically looking at water stress and those links globally. Thanks.
Great. I look forward to that. And Rowan?
My name is Rowan Moore Garrity. I'm a journalist freelancer. I live in New York. I'm here to talk primarily about a chapter in my book, called Go Tell the Crocodiles, which deals with human-crocodile conflict along the Zambezi River and how access to water plays into that.
Unanticipated consequences.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Monica Lewis Patrick. I'm the president and CEO of We the People of Detroit. Our work is centered in fighting for quality education for our children. It's also centered in the human right to water. We serve collectively on about 18 different water organizations and boards around the world. And so what we hope to do today is to help you understand that we also have a water crisis right here in Detroit and in Flint as it relates to water affordability and access.
Oh, terrific. A huge story with national ramifications and globally. So let me take you around the world really fast, breakneck speed. Again, I'm J. Carl Ganter, director of Circle of Blue, and that's our mission is really to cover what we feel is one of the biggest stories on the planet. Yes, Houston, we have a problem. Even the World Economic Forum says water is the number one global risk to geopolitical stability, to economies. Pretty much everything we care about intersects this water story. And you heard just a little vignettes here already teasing up what we're going to talk about. This slide doesn't really show up really well, but it's basically a transformation map with water at the middle and what it intersects from truly a risk perspective. So when you're looking, whether the corporate boardroom or the basement of the Pentagon, these are the types of things that people are looking at. And a couple, I hate just putting numbers up, but these are like four slides of really important numbers. 40% of the world's people are affected by water scarcity now. 2 billion, and that's with a B, drink unsafe water. So imagine that. Not just Flint, but we're talking about going to get your water. The water may be unsafe and make your children sick. 4.5 billion don't have a place to really to go to the bathroom safely. This is a huge issue. This is the other side of the water story, and that's the sanitation story. When we're doing particularly the global issues or even national, we're talking about infrastructure, the sanitation side oftentimes gets left out of the equation. And this number here really, really should stun us. 700 million people could be displaced because of a search for water. Displaced, we talk about migration. So we talk about triggers for these big issues. And then just look at the map and look at trends in groundwater depletion and look at stress points. Again, just really, really quick circle around the world here. Sao Paulo, you have migration into the city. The streets and the barrios are named for where they came from. This one was from a neighborhood in Sao Paulo. The people came because their crops failed. And now they moved to Sao Paulo looking for water, looking for jobs. Big, big pressures on our urban centers. Of course, our urban centers, we heard of Day Zero in Cape Town. These are other Day Zero candidate cities. We'll come back to all those. And we look at also either stress points or pull points. This is a project we did in China called Choke Point China, looking at the coal and an energy piece. I'm going to turn the lights down real fast here. But this is one of the largest coal mines in the world. And what happens is
I can do that so you can keep talking.
Yeah, okay, awesome. So what happens when they mine coal? We discovered that they don't have enough water to mine and process coal at current rates. So it starts driving people like Wu Yun here, who's the daughter of a shepherd, to move because their wells have gone dry. It also drives a national economy and national issue, security issue, because they can't mine and process coal at current rates. They can't process the coal. China can't. So it's also driving part of their renewables. There are actually interesting other side stories to the water story. The energy piece also, driving water up to Beijing. This is one of the world's largest infrastructure projects. It's a south-north water transfer project, moving water at unprecedented rates north to Beijing. We also find that when the unintended consequences, when energy is free, farmers in Punjab leave their wells running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They don't even have switches on their pumps. They hardwire the pumps. They literally run 24 hours a day. So it's mutual assured depletion. And what happens? What happens when you deplete the water? Well, wells start to go dry, and then farmers have to turn to other sources for water when their wells are dry. So in India, a story we just ran a few weeks ago, we called it the toxic time bomb. They're irrigating with industrial waste from paper mills like this one. This is a pulp mill north of Delhi that I photographed. And they're also finding that they'll irrigate as long as they can and grow their crops because they have children, too, that need to go to school. Here, north of Bangalore, wells are dry, so they're turning to raw sewage to irrigate. And this is his source of water for irrigation. They're planting rice here and industrial waste from the mills and the tanneries and the slaughterhouses. It's pretty awful. And here they're actually trying to get the beets ready for market. They wash them in groundwater at a washing station because the beets smell bad. But they sell them anyway, but they don't eat their own produce. So we're talking about water and food connections globally that also affects supply chains. Imagine if you're a company buying produce or buying even for sugar or other supplies or other products. So you look at also the climate change impacts and sea level rise. This is in the delta of the Mekong. What's happening here, this is probably one of the last rice harvests in this region. What's happening is you're seeing a mix of sea level rise and then lower flows from the Mekong. And this used to be a rice paddy. Now it's brackish water. He's raising shrimp. But then right around the corner, literally I turned around and there's the Mekong being held back only by mud and plastic. So you have entire populations that are transitioning as we speak right now, transitioning their crops, and then also just being pushed out of the lands that are being eaten up by river flows or floods or sea level rise. Australia, another big story to pay attention to is water and culture. This is Beryl Carmichael. Her entire life story is a river back through time, back to her ancestors. And when the Murray and the Darling ran slow, so did her connection back through time. So you also look at, we see this, of course, in Lake Erie, but toxic pollution, this is Lake Kunming, their drinking water supply. So they're trying to squeeze more food out of less land. They're using more fertilizer, which is running off into their water supplies. And, of course, we all remember Toledo and Lake Erie. This is what we do with our interns is we send them down with a GoPro and photograph the algae blooms. We call them our expendables. Just kidding. But anyway, and then, of course, the central U.S. Ogallala mapping the depletion of fossil water supplies, when we're looking at the true value of water, and when it's either free or subsidized, we tend to dig deep for it and use it for crops that may not be an optimal use. And then we also have to look downstream. We look at our indigenous and our First Nations. This is south of Phoenix. And when Governor Lewis declared this is the year of our water rights, literally that rippled all the way back to Washington because he'd like to see the Gila River run free again. So, of course, California, again, depletion, competition, all the stories rich here. The other piece of this is the big energy story in California. How many people know how much energy California spends, uses to pump and treat their water? Wow. It's huge. What? It's like
25%.
20. It's like 19 to 25%, depending on how it's calculated. Exactly. Also, we talk about the promise of big data to solve all of our problems. Sometimes it's not as easy. This is the Punjab Department of Irrigation data center. I was really careful not to wake up the servers. Sorry, it's a data joke. We also talk about the social justice issues. We hear about Detroit, but also we're looking at major companies and even governments and municipalities, a license to operate. Demonstrators in Catamarca, Peru, shut down a $5 billion gold mine because that mine had basically broken promises in managing the water supply. And of course, we turn to Flint, and we have young men and women and their children. I just knocked on their door. You know, his eyes cut right through me because he doesn't know if his child will be permanently damaged because of lead poisoning. But then also, in the room where it happens, this is Mongolia. This is where farmers came together with parliamentarians and even mining companies because there's minimal water in Mongolia, and the mines are using the water. They have to come to some sort of agreement because most of the economy in Mongolia is driven by mining, a bit by pastoral shepherding. And so they have to come to some sort of balance in a transition. This is the first time when they actually turned the chairs around in Parliament. It was really an amazing meeting. And how many people have heard of the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals?
Yeah.
Which one is water? Sorry, I gave it away up here. Goal number six. Another big story is how does water intersect with the Sustainable Development Goals? And a big story, too. It's news. It's now. We've been covering this for 15 years. And finally, it's starting to get some attention. The biggest story on the planet is... now hasn't been taken for granted. And right here in our own state in Michigan, of course, talking about the PFAS contamination and groundwater contamination. And then back to Wuyun, we always have to remember that there are real people at these stories, whether they're here in Flint, Michigan, or whether they're in far reaches of Inner Mongolia into the coal mine. The next time I went back, the mines were getting closer to her home. I've been back four times now into the same family. And the grasslands are turning to sand dunes. They look like sleeping bear. And so you also have now one of the world's largest coal mining and processing facilities in Inner Mongolia shipping the coal to Beijing and beyond. So these are all water intersections. And October 8th, how many people know what's happening October 8th? Isn't it the 8th? Is when the IPCC report comes out on climate change. So watch for the water intersections there because water and climate are inseparable. Water is climate. So I would argue, too, that we have a key moment of relevancy here, and this is what we're going to talk about. Why we care, why now, why this is such a big story. And then we'll take your questions. So that's around the world. That's my quick kind of itinerary, my camera. But now we're going to talk about some water. Oh, the cheerful topic. Water and conflict. And like I said, we'll do questions here. We'll do a quick kind of tease here of what we're up to, and we'll come back to questions.
Okay, great. I think I will use those slides.
Yep.
Are they
yep.
all teed up?
They're coming
okay,
up.
Okay, great. All right. Thank you. So, again, I'm a researcher for CNA. We do a lot of our work for the federal government. We're an organization of about 350 analysts and researchers, all with our own areas of expertise. A lot of what we do is, particularly in this particular space, having to do with climate, environment, energy, food, is to look into those challenges and try to understand them and then put them into terms that folks within the U.S. government who think about defense and national security can understand them. So part of it's a big translation piece where we know these things are taking place, but folks who make decisions about our national security and about our Department of Defense and about our Homeland Security may not have time to digest entire bodies of literature and research. And so we try to take these things and parse them and make them digestible and understandable for those types of decision makers, okay? So that's really what we're doing here for the question of the global water crisis, okay? So this is research that was done about 2 years ago. I have summaries of the report, and the report's available online. If you're curious, just let me know afterwards. This is a picture of a farmer in northeastern Syria in about 2011, this story was one of the important stories that we capture in our report, which is thinking about the extended droughts in that part of the world, their effect on agricultural communities, the fact that agricultural communities were uprooted and had to move to urban areas, and this all happened in the years preceding the Arab Spring and protests and riots, which eventually led to the ongoing continuing civil war in Syria. So let me get started here. Just a little background. I am a researcher. I partnered with our military advisory board at CNA, which is a board of 12 retired 3- and 4-star generals and admirals who take on issues of environmental, climate change, and resource scarcity. And so I partnered with them. I was the research lead. And then they bring to the work all of their years, collective years of operational and strategic thinking, right? So again, talking about that process of putting it into terms that national security leaders and decision makers can understand. A little bit of history. The intelligence community 10 years ago, so CNA put out a report 10 years ago that really put into terms this idea that climate change serves as a threat multiplier. Okay, so that was a big conceptual jump in thinking for the national security community to understand what's the so what for us for climate change. Okay, so it takes problems and it makes them worse in ways that the Department of Defense will have to respond to. So think about Katrina, think about internal things, think about humanitarian disasters overseas that the Department of Defense will have to respond to. Specifically on the water piece, about 5 years ago, the intelligence community issued and this is an unclassified document that you can find online, a document specifically on water stress overseas. And they concluded that water stress over time will be a bigger factor, a more prominent factor in conflict and instability, and so this is something that we should be watching. So our research really sought to... Ooh, that slide doesn't look so good. Okay. So our research sought to build on those two ideas and kind of bring it up to 2016 and thinking about, there's a lot of research that exists within the scientific community that says that water stress is happening, it's going to be a global problem, we need to worry about it. And some of those pieces of writing and articles and even some media, a lot of media coverage actually says, and people will fight about it, okay? So from the world that I come from, which is more of the security studies world, that's a big jump, right, to say that resources will be fewer, water will be less, and people will fight about it kind of in the Mad Max vein of things. When really what we, in order to make that case, we really need to understand what is the connection. So that was the goal of the research, was to kind of get into the grit and the details of, well, will people fight? What will that conflict look like? Will it actually be conflict? Will it just cause tensions? And all of these types of questions, and try to communicate that to national security decision think. So this slide really lays out one of our first kind of analytic judgments that we make early on in our research, which is that conflict and instability is almost always caused by multiple factors. It's almost rarely a single factor. So in order to think about water stress, there not being enough water to meet demand, as a factor in conflict and instability, we need to understand it as a factor, of which there are typically several or even many, right? And so this research for me grew out of some in-depth research that I had done several years ago on the Boko Haram conflict in northeastern Nigeria, which involved a couple of years of research trying to understand the drivers and the grievances at play in that insurgency, and kind of why are we seeing the emergence of that group? Why is the violence intractable? Why can't the government do anything about it? As part of that research, we identified 7 different drivers of conflict, some of which were political marginalization. There were ethnic tensions at play. It had to do with how the government was responding to the violence. It has to do with unequal wealth distribution of wealth to that part of the country. And so exploring all of those drivers. And inevitably, when I would brief that work, somebody would come up to me and say, Julia, this is really about Lake Chad, the Lake Chad Basin. Okay, and I would kind of think, okay, well, that's interesting. You know, you need to think about the environmental piece of this. So that got me interested in this line of research. And I did the research, and You know, this is based on a series of satellite images of the Lake Chad Basin, which has shrunk by estimates are 90 to 95% of its size over the last 40 years, okay, which is just huge. All right, so if you even just begin to think about the societal, the economic implications for the communities in that region, your imagination immediately goes wild. And you think about communities that are no longer able to feed their families, earn a living, huge fishing communities, no more fish. You know, and you can start to think about how an organization like a Boko Haram can start to take advantage of those conditions to their advantage for recruiting, putting people on the payroll, and so on and so forth. So that's the first idea, water stress as a factor, not necessarily the factor. The second piece is, as a conflict expert, you know, we know that there's different types of conflict and instability. You know, people think war. Okay, well, what's war? War between two countries? War within a country? So we have to understand that there's different types of conflict. And so in order to understand that link, we have to think about it within different types of conflict. So this is a very basic conflict spectrum that the Department of Defense uses. And they have various, you know, variations of this same conflict spectrum. But it's an escalation spectrum, starting at the very low end of conflict, which we define as kind of civil unrest, instability, protests, sit-ins, and so on and so forth. So we did kind of a global look around the world. And again, most of our work was outside of the U.S. And found that, sure enough, when you look at the research, there is almost a one-to-one connection in communities around the world that when there is a water-related crisis, when the water is turned off, when the water is shut down, when people can't get water, they take to the streets. And this isn't surprising, but the research backs that idea. Most of those cases globally, people will go home because the local government has some way of kind of muddling through the crisis, right? And people can go home. They can fix the broken main. They can bring in private water companies, but that introduces a whole different set of challenges and issues. They kind of muddle through, people go home. We found that this has the potential to be escalatory and has been escalatory if there are other grievances at play within that community, and this becomes one of many, right, or gets hooked into other grievances. And then you have kind of and the other piece is really how local security forces, local governments respond to the protests of riots. And that's, of course, true for any type of protest, right? If they decide to bring out cops who use violence against the protesters, if they shut off certain parts of the town or the city, and then you have the potential for escalation. If you go up the spectrum, you look at localized violence. This is violence between communities. So think about in between villages, tribes, local towns, what have you. Again, there is a connection here as well, and there's examples all around the world that I can touch on. One that we looked very closely at involves herder-farmer communities, where in Africa in particular, where there are herder communities whose grazing lands have dried up, particularly in the Sahel region of North Africa, and they're forced to move south to find grazing lands, and they're drying up because of extended droughts that are longer, and this links to climate change, of course. Moving into areas where sedentary farmers have been, you know, having their farms for hundreds and hundreds of years, and these communities move in, and it is creating conflict and violence between those communities. And those conflicts can also take on ethnic, religious tones as well. And so the Middle Belt in Nigeria is a place where that's happening. It's also happening in Kenya and several other places around the world. Sorry. The third category looks at conflict within civil wars. So think about Syria, Yemen, Libya, post-conflict Iraq, where you see the dynamics taking shape, particularly around kind of violent extremist organizations, Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, Al-Shabaab. All of these organizations have shown that they recognize the importance of water stress. These are organizations that are inherently in competition with governments. And so when there's a water stress-related issue, it provides an opening for them to move into to compete for populations following and recruitment and what have you. If they can provide water while local governments can't, that's very powerful. Okay, and we show that all these organizations do that and have done that and recognize the importance of water. So that's a picture of a force in Cameroon called the Beer fighting Boko Haram. And you can see the dusty conditions there kind of really drive home what those conditions are like. Finally, the fourth, and this is kind of good old-fashioned war between nation states. So will countries go to war over water stress? And really, historically, the record shows that countries tend to cooperate on water issues. Historically, it's been more of a mechanism for bringing people to the table. So you think of some of the biggest examples are India and Pakistan, who share the Indus River. who have avoided water wars despite wars in other fronts over 10 decades now. That's a 60-year-old treaty called the Indus River Treaty. It's been very robust. There's the Mekong River, which is also another potential hotspot. There's the Nile River between Egypt and Ethiopia, building the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. But these are places that we're watching. What our report kind of concludes on that point is, yes, cooperation has been the go-to mechanism to date. Water stress is getting worse. The conditions are getting worse. Populations are feeling it more and more severely over time. And that we certainly shouldn't rest on our laurels in terms of just because this has worked in the past, that it will continue to work in the future. The conditions are changing. In some places, they're changing quickly. So this is an area of concern that we raise in the report.
Great. Julia, we've got about 30
I'll
seconds.
I'll just end there because Perfect. The rest is, okay. I can get into, this is kind of the, what do we think should be done about it towards the U.S. government, but I will stop there and hand it over to Rowan.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah, yep. We sound a little urgent. It's urgent.
Yeah.
Okay, Rowan,
okay.
Take us to the river.
All right, so we're going to Mozambique. Oh, wait, there we go. This is a woman named, she calls herself Mai Rosa, which means Mother Rose. She lives in a village that's probably the westernmost village in Mozambique, so quick geographical primer. If you can picture Africa and then Madagascar, the island just to the east of southern Africa, Mozambique is where you would hit if you swam to Africa from Madagascar. So anyhow, so she lives along the Zambezi River, which is one of the largest rivers on the continent. And in her village, she's known as the King of Crocodiles. And the community where she lives, Bawa, is a place where crocodiles loom very large. They lost in sort of the 10 years before I spent some time there, from 2000 to 2010, they lost 50 people to fatal crocodile attacks out of a population of about 1,000 total. So that's, 5%. And one of the sort of analogies I sometimes use to think about it is if you think about how 9/11, which killed 3,000 Americans, kind of reconstructed our psyche and politics from the ground up. You can imagine that at the level of a small community whose sort of whole social and political environment doesn't really extend beyond where you can walk to, the impact of that is just massive. And so the reason she's called the King of Crocodiles intersects with a few things, but there are sort of traditions around how people believe that animal spirits are carried into the human world. But there are also two really important factors that have to do with water infrastructure. The first is a big piece of hydro infrastructure that is there where she lives. So she lives, and I should have prepared better slides, but bear with me. So she lives at the upper end of what's called Lake Cahorabasa, which is a lake that's about 150 miles long that was created in the 70s when the Portuguese, as sort of the last act of the colonial government, built a dam to generate hydropower. And actually, interestingly, on the war front, they have sold almost all of the hydropower from that dam to South Africa ever since, including during a 16-year civil war where the Mozambican government was fighting an insurgency funded by the South African government. So I guess, electricity supply also brings people around the table. But so what that lake did, what the creation of that lake did is basically you've got two rivers coming together right outside Rosa's house, the Luangwa and the Zambezi. And the flow slows down because as the water enters the lake, there's the dam. And all the nutrients, all the bug parts, all the plants, all the, microbial life, all of that sort of gets churned up into this sort of maple syrupy, very slow current. And crocodiles love it because not only is it a very food-rich environment for the fish and all the things they feed on, but also the water level of the river flooding all of these little narrow canyons on the sides created just basically this vast wilderness that a crocodile biologist who lives near there called Crocodile Heaven. So anyhow, there are way too many crocodiles for people to be near the river. It might be that way naturally, but it's certainly that way with the addition of this piece of water infrastructure. So that's the infrastructure cause from based on what's there. And the reason it comes up in conflict is both because of that and because of a piece of infrastructure that's not there, which is namely there's no water source for people there other than the river. And that's true up and down the Zambezi, where sort of in the aftermath of the Mozambican Civil War, you have people who had fled the country coming back and settling along the river and bringing back, you know, another generation of people, larger families and so forth. And they settle sort of all along this, you know, really vital corridor for wildlife on either side of the river. And this, what you're looking at, is a sort of makeshift chain link fence enclosure that people there built. I think there's another better shot of it, where they, you know, wash dishes, get, you know, wash their clothes, collect water for the household. And there's a, you know, people will sometimes make the point, you know, why do all these ladies hang out at the river if they know that you could get killed? And there's a really important kind of social context about, you know, the activities that, you know, going to the river brings you into contact with your neighbors. It's sort of an important time and place for people to commune. And also, people are not so sure about who the crocodiles are that kill you. So I'll go back to Mairosa for one second. Mairosa became known as the king of crocodiles because in 2010, she had a niece who disappeared. And reportedly, her niece who disappeared had gotten into an argument with her a couple days before her disappearance about whether she would give Mairosa some free fried dough that she was selling in the market. And so just like totally pedestrian, basic conflict among neighbors or family, and sort of a rumor, to be honest. And that led people to believe, and she's a widow, and widows there, as they have been throughout history around the world, are often sort of targeted for rumors of witchcraft. But so people quickly pointed the finger at her and said, you know, you've got a crocodile charm, and you have a pet crocodile that you send after your enemies. And so, you know, it kind of sounds a little bit outlandish, but this is where you come back to the 9/11 analogy, right? So, you know, it's like if 5% of your neighbors disappeared because of crocodiles, and that information sort of meshes pretty neatly with a narrative about you and your community's history and your relationship to the natural world, you know, you could see how that would be a compelling explanation. But basically, so there are no wells, there are no irrigation systems. Actually, there is one well. I think it's broken. I have another picture of it. But so the government's response here has been, well, how will we solve this problem? We'll go out, and every year we will shoot 100, maybe 200 crocodiles, maybe 300 crocodiles along the Zambezi River. And that is something that's immensely popular locally because basically, as people there will tell you, we would like the government to come out and hunt 100% of the crocodiles. But there are hunting operators who charge American dentists and other things thousands of dollars to come shoot these crocodiles. And what they'll tell you is if you come out and try to do a cull over a two-week period, you're not even going to get the crocodile that are eating people because it might be 2 months after the attack, it might be 3 months after the attack, and the bigger the crocodile, the more dangerous it is. And so you'll have these 60, 70, 80-year-old, very cagey male crocodiles that are very good at stalking their prey, and they are very good at sort of avoiding humans. And so, you know, the government hunters, you know, this is, I think, the biggest crocodile I saw them shoot. That was probably 10 feet long, which is just around the size threshold where a crocodile can be dangerous to humans. But anyhow, so I bring that all up to say that, you know, the sort of easy way out of this would be for someone to build some water infrastructure that would remove humans from the environment where crocodiles are so present and are present in such a dangerous way. And instead, what you have is sort of a government program that does nothing, this whole sort of, you know, rumor that actually endangers people's lives. So that Rosa was nearly thrown into the river in a sack, like a burlap sack, after she was accused of sort of disappearing her niece. And we're still no closer, and you're jeopardizing the revenue stream of trophy hunting in the area, which people can think different things about, but certainly has the potential to bring a lot of money there. So that I'll end there and just say that, you know, so this is the one well in Bawa not working last I checked or when I visited. There and almost anywhere you go in Mozambique, water is sort of at the root of other kinds of social, conflict. So you talked about license to operate. There's a huge multi-billion-dollar coal mine that's been shut down repeatedly because people who were resettled to make way for the coal mine were resettled onto land that had very poor access. They had been farming on the floodplain, basically, and now it had very poor access to water. There's no irrigation, so they rely on rain-fed agriculture, et cetera, et cetera. And there are all these ways where, even if there are kind of two or three layers of resentment and different players that get piled on top of it, water is sort of at the root or the genesis of these really complex forms of social conflict, even if people wouldn't conceive of them that way.
Great. Wow, thanks. I'm curious about the dentists and why they're drawn to crocodiles, but it's probably out of pretty
sure. Well, people try to get the big five, right? The big five are the dangerous seven, and the crocodile is part of the dangerous seven. So I guess once you've shot an elephant, you sort of try to collect all five.
Well, one of the roles in the water world globally in the sector is that it comes down to a well, and water is three things. It's local, and it's local, and it's local. And Monica's going to make it even more so here and put it in a local context and I think really put it in context why Detroit and why these other issues are really critical from even a global lens, right? Great, thanks. And your slides are in here too, so.
Oh, yeah.
There we go.
You want to explain this photo?
I added this. I brought our interns down to when she'll talk more about. But when Detroit was shutting off water to people who hadn't paid their bills in neighborhoods in Detroit, we came down and did a whole series of interviews and photographs and things. And this young woman was literally standing outside. Rumor was rippling through the neighborhood that the trucks were coming to turn off the water. So she was literally standing outside and just metaphorically, but putting her foot on the valve, and she was going to block them from turning off their water. So that's one of our pictures.
She actually did block them from turning off the water. Her name is, she's a water activist by the name of Valerie Jean.
That's right.
And it's not because people don't want to pay their water bills. They cannot afford to pay their water bills. If you look at water rates in the city of Detroit for the citizens of Detroit, water has gone up over the last 12 years 126%. Detroit actually provides water to about 3.8 million Michiganders. Almost half the state of Michigan gets its water from the city of Detroit. In 1955, the state of Michigan legislated Detroit to actually build out a system that Detroiters are the only ones on the hook for. And that's because Detroit was the only city with the bonding capacity to build such a system. If you look at the suburban sprawl that was around Detroit, many of those communities were getting sick from waterborne diseases because they did not have proper infrastructure. And so this here is a picture just with me and some of the people that are part of the Community Research Collective, because what we found is that when they won't believe the activists, sometimes they may believe the academics. The other thing that we found is that many of the entities that we consider the safeguards of public health and of our water system had failed us. So we knew that MDEQ was not operating in the best interest of the people of Detroit or Flint. We knew that the state of Michigan was not operating in the best interest of the people of this state. And this is why you're seeing so many water crises concentrated in this one state. But what happened is activists had to deputize themselves and become experts on water to be able to secure their own safety and their own public health. And so we created a research collective that consists of 67 experts and scholars and engineers and mathematicians and all of the best and brightest that you could think of from across the country. And they operate under We the People of Detroit, because what we want to make sure is that scientists will just study you. And they won't offer any solutions other than they studied you. And what we wanted to do is make sure that science was leading to solutions. And so we also knew that if you partnered with a university, they also want to own and control your data. So all the research that's done at the table with We the People of Detroit, we own it, we control it, and we hold it in proxy for the community. This year is where we started. We have sued the city of Detroit over 8 times through FOIAs to be able to just answer one question. How many people have been shut off from water in the city of Detroit, and how many people are still living without water? This is a question even till this day. We're looking at our 9th FOIA lawsuit to be able to answer this question. Well, just based on the fragmented data that we were able to get from the city of Detroit, what you will see is that there is not one neighborhood in the city of Detroit that has not been impacted by water shutoffs other than downtown and what they now call Midtown, and we still call Cass Corridor. What we also wanted to make sure, because as they were stealing Detroit's water system under the guise of failed black leadership in the city of Detroit, it was a bigger issue. It was never about righting the financial ship of the city of Detroit, but it was about seizing this major asset and using it to weaponize poor folks in communities like Detroit and Flint to gentrify those cities. And so when we looked at this, what you will find is the deep, dark turquoise is Detroit. But this entire system was financed by the people of Detroit. And when you look at the top of the T, that's Flint. Well, Flint was the largest external customer to the services that Detroit provides. What you will also find is around that deep turquoise, that now has been declared GLEWA, Great Lakes Water Authority. What you will find is that we provide water to 126 municipalities and townships. As I stated, 3.8 million Michiganders drink from the well of the city of Detroit. 78 municipalities, we pay 83% and they pay 17% of their CO2 cost. So that debt burden is still resting with the citizens of Detroit. But now what you have at the top of that T is that you had the rogue governance of this state actually force the citizens of Flint to build a third system that is running parallel with that top of the T line. It's called KWA. Well, KWA was never intended to provide any water source to the citizens of Flint. It is a raw water source that the governor manipulated because once he's out of office, he and Richard Baer planned on starting a fracking business. So what you have is the debt resting on the people of Flint under the guise, and I have to say it, they have used very predatory practices under this lens of racial what I consider a baked-in racial analysis for the state of Michigan. Because if you know anything about the history of Michigan, anything wrong in Michigan is Detroit's fault. But anything right, it's all the rest of us. And so what we did is we had to create visuals because what was starting to happen, because media was participating in spreading this narrative of deadbeat Detroiters. Black folks don't want to pay their fair share. So as you spread it, that narrative, what started to happen psychologically to the people that live in Detroit, they begin to take on that bad news. And so we wanted to give them a visual of what they had actually produced. They had produced one of the greatest water systems in the world. But because of the racist tactics in this state, ever since the first black mayor, Mayor Coleman Alexander Young, was put in office, then you saw them attacking and chipping away at that system. If you go back and look at the history, I think it was 1973, there was a federal judge by the name of Judge Fikens that was placed over Detroit's water system. He was supposed to just litigate or have jurisdiction over the fact that they had supposedly violated the Clean Water Act. He actually expanded his reach and began to influence contracts and make sure that those contracts went out to suburbanites who had fled the city. So as white flight went, our money also went with them. This year was critical to show that we built the system, that we paid for it, we invested in it, and we're still on the hook for it. This year was critical because we wanted people to know this narrative of deadbeat Detroiters, that we're actually subsidizing the suburbs till this day. As I stated, they pay wholesale, we pay retail, but the markup is happening at their own municipalities. So their municipalities are actually filling their budgetary coffers on the backs of this narrative that Detroit is gouging them when it's their own municipality. And what we found is that all the customers that we sell to are marking their water up anywhere from 100 to 1,000% and blaming it on Detroiters. This here is to show you that the governance structure, and what I always like to talk about is it's not just the GOP, y'all. Some Dems have been involved in this as well. and black folks too. Many of your emergency managers were black men. Emergency management is the law that they are using to create these very racist divides. And so what you find is, as you look at the structure here, Detroit had majority control over its board. Under the guise of emergency management, we have now restructured it to the very system that we own and are invested in is now controlled by the suburbs. So that was a big part of why they had to contrive the bankruptcy, is to convince the whole world that Detroit had failed. And what we know is that even in a financial downturn of 2008, if everyone that owed Detroit had paid their bills, we would have still been in the black. In the black. Yeah, the black. This here was just another breakdown of all the communities. I have no idea why it looks like this. But what it is, it really is a map. And that map shows that emergency management almost parallels with where the water system is. So emergency management, and for those that may not know, 53% of the African-American population of the state of Michigan, it has been under emergency management. If anybody tells you that emergency managers have gone, we are still living with the remnants of those bad decisions in all of these communities. This here was critical because people are not tie-barring that if you cannot afford your water, it also is leading to blight in these major urban cores. And so what we saw in Detroit is that in 1 year alone, in 2014, over 15,000 homeowners lost their houses just based on water debt. Well, Michigan's law says that you should not lose your home for water debt. It's only supposed to be taxed as a lien. They actually took it, and at the county level, they merged water debt and tax foreclosures together, and there's no separation. So when poor folks go to try to advocate for their homes to be restored, the county is saying, you owe. And we don't care where you owe, but to us, you owe. And so it becomes a revenue stream for the county to foreclose on homes. And these are just some of our researchers. But what I would also say to you, since the title of this is what?
Water Wars.
Is that in 2014, when we were going into coming through the bankruptcy, my mother is a retired master sergeant from the U.S. Army. And she's also a registered nurse. And when I began to tell her that they were going block by block and systematically shutting off tens of thousands of Detroiters, she cautioned me. And she said, shutting off water is an act of war. And then she began to quote to me the Geneva Convention. And after I listened to this lady, who's always serious, always, what I then recognized at that point is that we were engaging in war, and we had a community and a state and a country that was fully prepared to watch on the sidelines. What we also knew is that Flint got poisoned in their rush to steal Detroit's water system. And they considered Flint and Detroit dispensable. What we also know is that anyone that would believe that these emergency managers were not operating in collaboration, you're deceiving yourself. And the thing that we have seen repeatedly is that no one is reporting on the fact that Detroit is sitting right now in the largest hepatitis A outbreak in American history. And no one is connecting that to the fact that they are continuing till this day to shut off massive numbers of people from drinking water and sanitation. And so what I would hope that these folks in here would do is that you would go deeper, that you would begin to look at how these dollars connect, because the DeVos family is deeply connected to Veolia. And Veolia is deeply connected to what is happening with water in the state of Michigan. And so a lot of people fear saying these things. I say them because I fear not saying them. Because my community has actually been rendered a death sentence on the backs of a comeback for wealthy billionaires in downtown Detroit.
Amazing group we did. We each did a day-long seminar in 10 minutes. Pretty not bad. Not bad way to start. I'm not going to ask any questions because we're all in the journalism community here, and I'll probably have way better questions than anybody in the water space can think of. Truly the power of data for transparency and accountability, and then the stories connected to water dripping out of Detroit are just truly incredible and applicable to other parts of the world and other parts of the country. So the rules for questions, short, brief, identify yourself, and direct the question to one or more of our panelists here. So let's get started. We have about 25 minutes, almost half an hour, so this will go really quickly. Yeah?
I'm Katie Gagel. I work at Science News, but previously I was 8 years in India, and you guys were all great, but I'm limited to a question for Julia. In my research, I found that 170-some water treaties have pretty much, as you said, all been upheld, and there haven't been any deviations or problems, which is usually seen as this wonderful example of how communities can cooperate. Is there something about the way that water treaties are being drafted, the way that they're designed, that makes them particularly successful versus other kinds of treaties? Or what is sort of the magic factor that's holding them together up to this point, if there is one?
Well, that's a really good question. And there are folks who I can point you to as well who look specifically just at that question. I mean, from
Julia, if you could just repeat a little bit of the question up front before you answer, that'd be great.
So the question, as I understand it, is the trend has been cooperation and turning towards institution for working through conflicts versus turning to conflicts, and why have they been robust and worked? What about them has been robust and worked so far? I look at this question from a kind of conflict perspective, and if I kind of put my like realism hat on and I'm a state actor and I think about what do I have to gain by fighting over a river, right? I think if you take it to that kind of basics and we think in those terms, which is what we did for the study, particularly if you're the downstream riparian, you don't have a ton to gain, right, by kind of invading a neighbor. And can you take control of the river? Do you have to permanently? So just in kind of a very pragmatic perspective, there's a lot of cases out there that show that there isn't a whole lot to gain by actually going to violent conflict over a physical thing like a river. And then there's also just, getting to the hydrology piece in the Civil War with Mozambique and South Africa, you have to respond to the needs of your population while that conflict is taking place, right? And so you're responding to an internal need, right, that you have to maintain throughout the course of the conflict, which is also a very strong driver in terms of your decision-making calculus. So it has made sense, pragmatically speaking, to work through those conflicts in that particular area, even though there may be tensions and disagreement in a whole bunch of other areas. Those institutions have worked. But again, the other thing that we considered is, can nation states take actions that are aggressive but not necessarily military-based against the neighbor, using information operations, trying to influence internal politics, things like this, and particularly in the world that we're seeing today and the use of information as conditions get worse? I think that would certainly be something worth considering. Is kind of not direct aggressive military action, but other kind of efforts that are more under the radar to undermine a neighbor, weaken a neighbor, challenge a neighbor, whatever the case may be, about control of water.
Wow, and also finance too, right?
Of course, yes. Yep, yep, absolutely.
Great. Yep. Who's next? Sure.
Well, I know that the DWSD is doing that kind of work in terms of looking at leakage and water loss, but what I would say to all of you is if you do your research on water affordability, if you set the rates at a rate that is that people can pay, then what you will find is you will bring more water into the coffers. That's the reason why Roger Colton, who is a national expert on water affordability, was brought in 2005. Detroit actually formulated the first water affordability plan in the country. The very policy that Philadelphia and Baltimore are implementing now was drafted in Detroit by the Honorable Councilwoman Joanne Watson and the late, great Marianne Mahaffey. So this is not just about leakage and problems in the system. We have pipes that are made out of log wood. We have pipes that are made out of galvanized iron. What we find, though, is that as you saw major blight in the city, since 2009, we saw over 100,000 households illegally foreclosed on. So when you have that kind of massive displacement intentionally, illegally, go to a page called illegalforeclosures.org. Illegalforeclosures.org. There's a great professor by the name of Bernadette Atenehu who actually looked at the copulation of water debt being imposed on homeowners that then forced them into poverty and the loss of their property. And Detroit's system is ran by gravity. So when you don't have the full force of water going through that system, when you have lost, intentionally and strategically lost, a significant part of your population, then you are going to see massive parts of an infrastructure lying dormant.
Great. Thanks.
Okay, so the question is about kind of a downstream neighbor and what tools, mechanisms they may have to kind of apply pressure on an upstream neighbor, like in the dynamic between Turkey and Iraq, for example. This was a focus. So there was a researcher who worked specifically on this question, and he goes into great detail in the report on this. But to keep it short, very few, right? I mean, there are very few options. If you look at the situation between Ethiopia and Egypt with the GERD, you know, and the Indus River, there are major international efforts that involve the United States and other international organizations that have paid attention to these situations and been active in making sure that those are strong institutions and bringing the players to the table and keeping the kind of negotiations alive, right? And that has been very strong and very powerful, particularly when you have countries that are at war or in tension over other issues, not just the water issue. And I get the question about Iraq and Turkey quite frequently. And, I mean, Iraq is a place that, you know, I'm watching very carefully because, of course, they're in extended drought. The government's not responding there. Protests on a daily basis, 30,000 people without water on a given day. So it's a hot spot, but it's also a government that isn't necessarily – that's dealing with so many problems that isn't necessarily able to interact with the Turks in a way that's effective and may not have tools. And so my view on that is that, you know, the U.S. and others can be a leader on that, but it has to put attention to it. It has to take the lead. It has to make it a priority. That's one way that I think about it.
Great.
You mentioned your mother invoking the Geneva Convention in regards to water shutoffs. I remember that the UN came in 2014 and basically came to the violation of human rights. Have you seen any shift in policy after that UN combo?
Where I've seen the shift is in the fact that the activists have really turned up the heat. We have really been very intentional about intersecting this issue at every opportunity. I have seen in this state, I would say in the last 2 years, water affordability was not on anyone's radar. In the last 2 years, what you have seen is you've seen foundations and nonprofits and large EJs come together because they recognize the looming threat. Research just recently came out, last year from Michigan State, from Dr. Elizabeth Mack, that we're looking at, by the year 2020, 37% of the country not being able to afford their water. What we know in Flint and Detroit is those two municipalities have the most egregious water shutoff policies in the state of Michigan. And so I believe that we are beta test for what the rest of the nation will tolerate. But as it relates to the UN, we are in ongoing conversations with them. I did a report maybe about 10 months ago to update them as to where things are in terms of water inequities and injustices. But what we are not waiting for is we're not waiting on anyone to rescue us. If you look at Flint, it was activists that educated everybody that they were being poisoned. And then you still saw government move slowly in terms of responding. And so what we know is that we, as citizens and as community, have to deputize ourselves. And we have to be the champions in terms of providing solutions. But the UN, I'll tell anybody, they're a bully pulpit. And they're a wonderful way to be able to lift your issue. But it was really the fact that we were willing to do this hard knuckle kind of down in the trenches work of providing science and research and really driving the question into these arenas where people want to talk about conservation and saving the plants and the planet but don't have any connection to the people. Or people want to talk about how are we going to make sure that people pay their fair share, but they're not enforcing that in government. The state of Michigan owed the city of Detroit $7 million on two properties where they didn't pay their water bill. But the narrative is deadbeat black folks in Detroit don't want to pay their fair share. And so we had to use the UN to validate the issue and raise it so that it wasn't being racialized and just sort of swept under the carpet. And so, like I said, I would look to the activists, the frontline practitioners, the people most impacted for the leadership that we all need to resolve this issue.
Great. Thank you. Who else? What else we have here? Great. Right up here in front.
I can say. So indicators of a potential water crisis, and how can you kind of think about those and identify those in order to get ahead of the curve? In the places that I look, certainly as a result of climate change, we're seeing extended droughts and more frequent droughts, right? And we're already in this in parts of East and Central Asia, in Africa. And so those indicators are already there in places where there are frequent and extended droughts. We are already seeing water crises, and we will continue to see water crises. And those can come in the form of famine. They can result in population movements. They can spark conflicts, like I talked about, at the local level. But it's also circular. You can also kind of see where there's already violence and conflict taking place. And if you dig deeper in many parts of the world, you will see that water is already a factor. It's just been long overlooked. So I'll stop there.
Yeah, and one of the big pieces, too, is the whole urbanization issue.
Yeah.
Because with megacities now, we have this water and sanitation choke point, this real challenge. So how will the big megacities of today survive?
Yep.
And then what kind of relationships will they build with the rings around them, the kind of para-urban areas as far as water sharing, as far as agriculture? You saw in India, what we're seeing is you're seeing this really tug of war as the systems are pushing back. You're seeing less groundwater being aquifers being recharged.
Yep.
They're not. And then the farmers overdrafting. And then what happens? So you start to see the indicators like locations like Yemen or the hotspots like potentially Bangladesh.
Yep.
Well, you have one here, too.
And you have one
because the government has already decided. We know that we need about $3.5 trillion to do a major upgrade of our infrastructure. The decision is to only commit $1.74 trillion. What that says to me as an activist and a frontline practitioner, somebody's already decided who's going to drink and who will not.
And some of it, too, is just a lack of awareness. How many times we talk about water, how many times we talk about sewage overflows into the Great Lakes, and who's willing to actually pony up and pay for the infrastructure repairs? Back here.
But let's talk about pay. If we treat this issue as a national security issue, which it is, when you look at the public health impacts, when you look at what is happening in terms of just commerce, all of those entities intersect. And what we know is that if we would begin to talk about our infrastructure and making sure that there is a human right to water in this country, then we can treat it as a national security issue. And we know anytime we talk about national security, we can always find money for that.
In the back, over here.
I'm sorry, I've been late, so forgive me if I'm asking a question that you guys already addressed. But I've been really worried about what's happening in South Africa because I've been reading about them turning up the water. It's going to be, they're running out, right? Did you guys address that at all? Can anybody? Because I've been seeing this, it's been coming into my various feeds, and I'm like, this can't be true. The other part of me is going, yeah, it probably is. So I just figured since this is the one question I wanted to ask.
And if you can tell us where you're from, your name?
My name is Ronald Donato, and I'm from Chicago, and I was with the UPI Chicago Tribune and I'm freelance.
Great.
I teach, so I've been indoctrinating students.
Well, I mean, we talk.
I put up a
slide of what we call day zero candidate cities, and I was talking to his name is Ben Braga, and he took over the Sao Paulo emergency. If you remember, Sao Paulo almost ran out of water a couple of years ago. It didn't get the same attention that Cape Town did. Cape Town is just a more beautiful city. I didn't want to offend anybody from Sao Paulo, but it didn't have the right meme. All of a sudden, somebody came up with day zero, so you had a countdown to no water. And now there are day zero candidate cities. There is a list, and this is not necessarily in the priority that I showed, but these are cities that could run out of water maybe not tomorrow, but day after tomorrow, like Cape Town, actually putting a time clock. So what do you, you know...
And is that dayzero.com? Who puts it out? I mean, is it a legit source?
I don't know. I don't know about dayzero.com. But there are a lot of people looking at how do you build resiliency into these cities so you don't end up with conflict and failure. I mean, in theory, you could end up with some very... Well, you had the potential of going from... you saw the lions in Cape Town, a huge shift in lifestyle, which fortunately, a lot of the lifestyle changes have taken hold, and people are being much more conserving water and shows that there's a lot more space. But
the optics of poverty is more digestible for most of the world if a black face is put on it. So that's why Cape Town was more progressive in terms of being able to take this moment and uplift it to get attention and science to address this issue. You've got issues of disparity going on all around the globe.
Right.
It just was the convenience of the moment because, like I said, the optics were more palatable to take a dark face and then put that face on this message of disparity. Because we don't want to believe that that's happening right here, but it is. You've got third world conditions in a country that declares itself a first-class country, first-class nation.
One thing I just wanted to note that was an interesting parallel to what you were talking about just before the panel in Detroit is, in Cape Town, I read there have been a number of water-related arrests, right? So government employees stepping out and filling jugs illegally. There are people arrested for going to the spigots in public cemeteries and things like that where there are public water sources available. And then there's this just sort of massive atmosphere. Conspiracy almost puts the wrong tone on it, but in a way it's that where it's like you got the sense that even though it got through the crisis – there had been this kind of destruction of credibility, and it. What you said about Detroit just before the panel really resonated, where you have potential implications with people losing custody of their kids when their water gets shut off, losing their homes when water gets shut off, and you can just imagine that, you know, it sort of destroys all credibility that any face of the government might have or any face of authority might have in that area afterwards.
Yeah, and also
speaking to, if you don't have running water in the state of Michigan for 72 hours, you're in imminent danger of losing your children and also your property. The two communities where this is happening most aggressively are Flint and Detroit.
Wow. A couple more questions. We only have 6 or 7 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Itza Castañeda. I'm from Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I work for the International Union for the Conservation of Nature for the Global Gender Office. And my question is related to gender issues. Mm-hmm. And I would like to ask Monica, if you have
across the information about race and gender, sex segregated data in your research? And also for Rowan, if these people that disappear, do you have numbers of how many were men and how many were women? And about the displacement of the people that have been displaced also, how many are men and how many are women? This is important for us. We are doing a research on that, and I would like to know if you have that information.
We have not broken it down from that perspective in terms of gender, because for us it was about, one, just being able to manage through our crisis, which we're still living in. This morning I got here, and before I left, I had to make sure a water delivery got done. And what I find is that most of this work is being done by women of color. What I will tell you for the city of Detroit, 60% of the population are women of color, single heads of household. 70% of the people that work in Detroit don't live in Detroit. 49% of the population in Detroit is living in abject poverty, and those are the numbers. Now, if we need to break it down, I can definitely, we can exchange information, and I can see if I can give you that kind of statistical information. But for us, we were trying to figure out how to get the water back on for our community, and we were trying to use science to address the fact that there was a looming health impact to shutting off water.
It also does come back, and it comes back to the whole gender issue here, because who carries the water? You carry the water this morning, but who carries the water around the world? And it's usually the women, and it's usually the young women. And what happens when they're carrying the water? They're not going to school. What happens when you bring water and sanitation to villages and cities and urban areas? Kids go to school. They have a place to go to the bathroom. They have a place that's safe. They have safe drinking water, and they have health.
Well, look at Cochabamba. Cochabamba is a perfect example of where they went from a public system to a private, back to public. Tawana Petty's here, who really orchestrated a long conversation that we've been having with Cochabamba for a couple of years. And what we found, one of the things they did once they went back to a public system, they instituted within their governance structure that 60% of the persons presiding over the water commission have to be women. So to me, it says Cochabamba's pretty smart.
I'll just mention, so the question about gender disparities in sort of who's impacted by human crocodile conflict on the Zambezi, there's not good data that's kept in Mozambique, but there is a really interesting database maintained by this crocodile biologist and about crocodile attacks, and his name is Richard Ferguson, and he did a study in a nearby river in Malawi called the Shiri River, whose findings were really interesting. Basically, he did surveys 10 years apart of crocodile attacks along the Shiri River, and what he found was in the first one and the second one an identical density of attacks, right? So the same number of people being attacked per kilometer of shoreline per year. But what had happened in the 10-year period is that I think it was CARE International had put in borehole wells in every community along both sides of the river. And so who was attacked changed dramatically. In the first survey, the overwhelming majority of victims were women and children, so people who would be doing domestic chores at the riverside. And in the second survey, those people now had access to a safe water source. And so the next easiest target, because crocodiles are pretty efficient hunters, were fishermen who were sort of out fiddling with their nets in, you know, tippy dugout canoes, or in some cases fishing from an elevated reed platform just above the water. You know, humans are pretty predictable, but it was a striking change just by the addition of those wells.
Wow. You know, we only have 2 minutes, so if there's a super fast question here, I was going to ask our experts, our panelists, our guests here, just to give it kind of a 30 seconds of really either what we didn't talk about or what's the key point we need that we're going to be seeing the next 5 years. I mean, 2030 is right around the corner. We keep using that as a benchmark. We keep using the Sustainable Development Goals as benchmarks. You know, we use the state of Michigan, and our water system survival is kind of benchmarked. What are the key things we're going to be seeing in the next year to 5 years in the water conflict, water wars world?
I can't say for sure, but I think you opened up by saying that you're seeing kind of a groundswell of attention to this particular issue, which I'm observing as well across the government and at that level. You know, what I would like to see is one thing we've touched on, and Monica, of course, has talked about water management and water infrastructure and things that we can actually do something about. And so conversations more and more about addressing, seeing those indicators and getting ahead of the curve. There's so much opportunity to do that, obviously at home, but around the world as well. And so that's where I hope the conversation goes increasingly over time.
Great. Yeah, right. That's our little alarm. So we'll keep going here for just a second.
I don't think I have any nuggets of wisdom, but I was really struck by those sort of top-line numbers you put up about access to sanitation and fresh water, because there's so many kinds of conflict that are downstream from a lack of water infrastructure or from sort of decisions about how that gets meted out. And it seems like as we see more and more people move into cities and closer quarters where you have to sort of compete with your neighbors on some basis for access to sanitation or water, it could get really, really ugly, because it's, you know, it gets divided along racial lines, it gets divided along ethnic lines, it gets divided along all kinds of other axes, and we kind of lose sight and are unable to recover, you know, the sort of notion that water is at the center of it.
Great. And Monica, 30 seconds.
I want to send you to some resources, since you're a journalist. You got to get this book, Mapping the Water Crisis, The Dismantlement of African-American Neighborhoods in Detroit. It'll give you the breakdown and some of the history on what's going on with the water system there. There's also work going on that's being sponsored by the Joyce Foundation and Health Impact. And there is work going on nationally to collaborate with healthcare providers and frontline practitioners on really guiding the policies for the lead and copper rule nationally. And then also what I would say to you is that there is collective work that is happening all across the nation through U.S. Human Rights Network, through the work that we're doing here in the state of Michigan with the Michigan Water Unity Table. And what we also must remember all the time is that out of the Great Lakes, you see 85% of the bottled water that's consumed in the country is coming out of the Great Lakes. If we continue to ignore the fact that Nestle is extracting water and they are not doing it in a way that is equitable and that is responsible to the environment, then shame on all of us as Michiganders for not holding them accountable. And if you think bottled water is your go-to resource, then if the Great Lakes are destroyed, you don't have a go-to either. And that's even if you don't live in the Great Lakes.
Great. Well, that's a great way to leave it today. And also, fantastic. And I think we always have to remember that behind these numbers are real people, are real lives, like the Morassi family here. When I go to these places, I think of the young women that took me that morning, and also I think of the new UN World Bank report that talks about if children don't have access to safe water when they're young, they actually have a lower IQ. So it's up to us to define this next generation. So thanks so much. Appreciate it.